This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
Welcome back to the Monday edition of Power Perspective. Thank you very much for engaging with us during our open line. Well, of course, the dominant story was the story of a certain Tokyo Sekwale, and as luck would have it, that name is probably going to filter into the conversation we are about to have now, because over the next hour or so, we're going to be focusing on a very important but perhaps very misunderstood concept of whistleblowers, particularly in a country like ours in South Africa, where, if anyone has been paying attention to the Zondo Commission over the past couple of years, you sit there thinking, dear God, how on earth could that have happened? And we've seen the whistleblowers coming through, telling their horrific and harrowing stories, and some of them have just left you shell-shocked. One of the whistleblowers who did indeed take the stand to the Zondo Commission to tell us her story is Bianca Goodson, who actually worked for an entity called Trillion Management Capital. How does this link to Tokyo Sekwale? Well, at some point in time, he was the chairperson of Trillion at large, and he was on a very healthy retainer, as it turned out, of 500,000 rand per month. 500,000 rand per month. That was a retainer that Tokyo Sekwale used to get from Trillion when he was their chairperson. And as things turned out, at some point in time, he started asking particular questions. He ended up commissioning a particular investigation. And after that investigation, he said, oops, I'm out. But by the time he said that, many more things had happened within Trillion. So here we are speaking to Bianca Goodson. We're also joined on the line by Solly Mueng, and we're also trying to get hold of Arthur Williams, who used to be at Bain. So I want to start with you, Bianca. Firstly, good evening and thank you.
Good evening and thanks for having me as well. Thanks, Kaya.
Let's go back 5 short years ago, January 2016. It's a new year. Everybody's saying, "You, I've got New Year's plans. I've got resolutions." Bianca says, "I'm starting a new job. It's all good to go." Then what happens?
Oh, gosh. And then the worst 3 months of my life happened after that, hey?
Yeah,
yeah. So I was, you know, happily working for the whole of January and February. And then it was just myself and my COO, because I brought on somebody to help me set up the company. And then in March of that year, things changed because all these people from regiments joined Trillion, you know. Masilo Mutepo, for example, being one of those people. And there were so many dodgy things that had happened during those 3 months that eventually on the 18th of March, I decided to leave. It was an unplanned resignation. And then the rest is history, hey? And since then, I've become like a professional whistleblower, if you can call it that. It's like I'm a walking evidence docket. It's insane.
Yeah. Bianca, how did you end up at Trillion in the first place? Were you on the job market? You stumbled upon an an advert that said, "We're looking for a CEO. These are the skills." I mean, how did you end up with the job in the first place?
No, I was happily employed at Anglo American before that. You know, I had no reason to leave. I'd actually just survived a gruesome restructure at Anglo. So I had a lot of job security at the time because I had just survived this restructure. I had a new position within the group. I was very happy. And then there was this friend of mine who turned out to be a mutual friend between myself and Clive Angel phoned and told me that, you know, this gentleman, Mr. Angel, was looking to start up or he was setting up a company on behalf of the major shareholder. Didn't tell me all the details at the time what the shareholder was and stuff. So in essence, I was headhunted, and I was headhunted in the initial conversation with somebody that I did trust. So I had no reason to go into this thinking that it was anything weird.
Yeah, and of course, you know, generally, if a person is hired by an established entity, you can log onto a website, see what's going on there, and then make a call. But it's very difficult when you are going to join a startup entity, because you probably do have to go on a limb of faith.
100%, and that's exactly what happened here. When I first found out about it, I didn't know a lot about regiments. The first time I met Eric Wood was in one sort of like the interview process. And that was the first time that I'd ever heard of a company called Regiment. And that still wasn't important to me because all I knew was that Trillion was a new entity. You know, and at that time, there was an entity called Trillion Asset Management that had existed. And what I know now in hindsight was that Salim Issa actually bought that company, Trillion Asset Management, from Daniel Roy because it had all the financial licenses. And then basically took that company and converted it into Trillion Capital Partners. You know, so even when you go on the internet and you search all these different things, like you just didn't get the sense of comfort that it was an established company, but that was explained, you know, that it was also a startup. I remember Clive using the words that Trillium is half pregnant, you know, which didn't make sense because half pregnant in the sense that it's a startup, I'm going to be there starting it up in January 2016, but come March of 2016, all these people from regiments and all this work from regiments, so to say, would just transfer. And that's how it was sold to me.
And during those particular couple of months, you'd have obviously been trying to just put things together, put resources. At what point in time did you then start seeing that actually maybe the picture was a bit more pregnant than what you had thought it was?
You know, to be completely honest with you, in hindsight, you know, it's easy to say so many things in hindsight. I guess one thing in hindsight is that it probably, you know, the fact that Mohammed Bobet and Eric Wood were part of the interview process or the onboarding process, for example, should have, you know, maybe been the first flag for me. But things started going a bit weird. In February of 2016, the media was a buzz about Mr. Van Rooyen's special advisors,
yeah.
Right? And Mohammed Bobet was one of them. And that's when the slippery slope started because I had met Mohammed. You know, suddenly you're reading these articles in these papers that's making headlines, and there's a few too many faces in the the pictures that you can recognize, you know? And that was in about February 2016. And then by the middle of March, I mean, because I resigned on the 18th of March, so to call it the middle of March, you know, I'd resigned and I'd left. And in that period, too many weird things had happened.
Yeah. Power listener, we are speaking whistleblowers. Are they protected in the country? Is there enough security for them? If you'd like to engage with us, 0861-987-000. I have Bianca Goodson, who is a former Trillium CEO and also now a whistleblower. I also have Solly Mweng, a managing director at Don Valley Reputation Managers. And hopefully we'll also have Arthur Williams joining us shortly. Solly, you know, when we start talking whistleblowing, we're probably talking something that is a series of events that culminates in someone saying, I want to get out of here. From what you've seen, the whistleblower, if you want to call it journey, I mean, what does it look like?
I really, really appreciate, and I think all of South Africa should appreciate people like Bianca who stood out, because what she did was really serious martyrdom, as it were, professional martyrdom, because she had to sacrifice everything that she had worked for, she had studied for over the years, because she said, I can't allow anyone to do this to South Africa. And there are many people like her out there. We know we need to move at some point beyond having discussions, because it's really great to have this discussion, to saying, what do we now do to make sure that other Biancas like her do not have to be in the same position as her? Because these are the people who found themselves one day in a situation where they saw things being done that were not in the public interest, that were actually destroying, that stood to destroy, to take away resources from the people of South Africa. And they said, no, I'm not going to be part of this. I'm not going to benefit from this because it's wrong. And I'm not going to sign that piece of document because it cannot be right for South Africa, and no matter what happens. And they did. And because of the people like Bianca, we got to know a lot of things, that some of which are in the courts or at the Zondo Commission. So we really have to appreciate the pain that people like her go through. And you know, and you really need to look at, I'm very happy to hear her smile and laugh, you know, like that. She has not always been laughing, and many of her are still not laughing, because it was painful, because they got through pain, through points where they said, you know what, do I take my life? What's going on? What have I done to be where I am? We have to celebrate them for that.
Solly, the very first thing that happens to all of us when we join a new employer, you sign an employment contract, it comes with this implicit code of amateur, this code of silence that says whatever you see in here, you dare not say to anyone else. I mean, if you look at the journey of whistleblowers, I mean, there have been a lot, maybe starting even from the days of Enron. How do people balance that employment contract with its limitations versus the question of, hey, boy, it's my country being stolen?
Yeah, you know, I like this question. The truth is, maybe there are many, many other people out there who sit there and say, you know what, I'm not going to say anything because if I do, I'm going to lose my car, I'm going to lose my salary, my house, I'm not going to be able to pay school fees for my kids and all that. It's not an easy decision. It's never an easy decision. But there are a few, and they are a minority. There are a few like Bianca and others out there who say, you know what, I'm sorry, I can't. My conscience, whether they're looking at it from a personal values perspective, from a religious perspective, from a cultural perspective, people say, a few people like say, you know what, I cannot allow this to happen to South Africa. I cannot allow this to happen to my country. Because at the core of every business activity should be a public interest. And when you have people who say, you know what, I could walk away with this with like a 600 million rands, you know, like the former deputy finance minister who was offered, apparently was offered 600 million rands by the Guptas. And he said, you know what, I could go away and I would never have to work again for the entire life and my kids, but I can't. I can't do this to South Africa. And people like those have to be, it's not an easy decision. I know, and I, as a consultant, I have worked with others that I will not mention because they have to mention themselves, who have walked away from state-owned enterprises for having said, no, I can't do this to South Africa. And I love people like those.
Bianca, at some point in time, you would have had to reflect of, actually, barely 12 months ago, I observed a very brutal restructuring at my previous employer, being Anglo-American. Here I am with a job opportunity. Can I afford to put it all at risk? Talk us through how you actually just had to deal with those tensions at the point in time when we got to the middle of March 2016.
Yeah, it actually wasn't. You make it sound more difficult than it was. It was easy. It was almost like getting a wax, to be honest with you. And it was probably that painful as well, because I resigned at 6 o'clock on a Saturday morning. I woke up at 2 o'clock that morning and I wrote the resignation letter, and it took me 4 hours to write it. Just before I woke up, I was married at the time. I woke up my husband and I just said to him, I said, look, I've just got to resign. And maybe he was still sleeping and he thought it was a dream or something. He just like looked at me and he's like, okay, do it. And that's how I woke up, typed the resignation letter, and I sent it off at 6. But the day preceding that was really the straw that broke the camel's back. And this was when I was instructed by the directors of Integrated Capital to open a Bank of Baroda account for Trillion, after Trillion had already secured a business bank account at APSA. And that was, for me, what just made me realize that something was just incredibly, incredibly wrong. I was very emotional. I had spoken to my husband about it, not that I wanted to resign. I just told him how scared I was about it. And it was the weirdest thing because I couldn't exactly articulate what I was scared of. All I knew is that I wanted nothing to do with this. Got home, and I think I drank like a bottle of wine just to try and forget about it, eventually stopped crying and went to bed. You know, so it wasn't even attention. It was overwhelming, and it was just so clear to me that even if it was something that I didn't understand, it was still something that I wanted nothing to do with. So that's what was clear with for me. Later on, however, after I left Trillion and the media was abuzz about state capture and Trillion's involvement and Regiment's involvement in state capture, that's when I started experiencing conflict. And that's when I started thinking that I was part of this machine by association. I must be guilty, even although I didn't do anything. And that started this really terrible spin into trauma. But the conflict for me actually came afterwards, and it actually stayed around for a long time.
And Bianca, you know, when you then had that one particular moment relating to the opening of a bank account, for example, I think the Bank of Baroda became known as the institution where those that had been rejected by the other established banks will probably go. So I suspect that anxiety was probably initiated by that red flag associated with just what Bank of Baroda had become those days.
Absolutely. I mean, and it was in that year that I started finding out about the Bank of Baroda. It was in that year that I started finding out a lot more about Salim Issa, you know. And I found out so many things after I left. I mean, there was a part of me that was just so grateful that I did leave when I left, you know, that I wasn't pushed out, that I didn't stay there any longer than I had to. I still think that I stayed there for 3 months too long. Mm. But But yeah, I mean, I'm still in therapy. I still see my psychiatrist every single week, right? The other day, I was busy helping one of these law enforcement agencies because I've got financial skills, and we were looking at some of the money flows locally. And they gave me a Bank of Baroda bank statement, right? And I even went into my, because I still have a copy of my Trillion computer, I went into my Trillion computer to see what is the account number of the Bank of Baroda account that I opened, right? And that was the bank statement that I was looking at. And to actually see that the source of that money was actually from the Transnet pension fund and how it went towards the purchase of Tequesta, I mean, I ended up in a psychiatric hospital when I saw that. And this was years later. This was only, I think it was last year, when I actually saw for myself what that account was actually used for. I mean, it put me into such a traumatic state that my doc met me for a few days. You know, so I mean, it's what this stuff does to you is crazy, hey? It's really insane.
Bianca, that tension where you suddenly feel a bit complicit, a bit implicated, it can't be an easy one. And some of the literature that we've seen always says, well, for a person to be a whistleblower, they either have to have a type of proximity to the transactions or they have to have been involved and then say, actually, this is too much. How do you deal with that?
You know, the thing is, I come from a very religious family. So both my parents are pastors. So, I mean, I grew up, my parents were strict, eh? I couldn't drink, couldn't smoke. I do all the bad things now. But like when I was growing up, I was really, really strict. And one of the things that my parents always instilled in me was that I must be very conscious about the company that I keep. I remember the once, I mean, because back in the day, you know, your parents could still give you a hiding. They actually got a hiding for keeping the wrong company, right? And one of the things that now is, even although I'm an adult, I guess that those values still resonate with me so much. And the guilt that I sit with is that I kept the wrong company. It was only for 3 months, but I kept the wrong company. And it's not something... I'm learning now that I've just got to be a lot more forgiving with myself, because the truth is that I didn't know. Mm. You know, I was in close proximity to the stuff, but I didn't know what they did. I didn't know what the intention was. And as you find out more and more about it, the guilt just gets worse, eh?
Yeah.
So I'm not speaking to you like it's over. I don't think my journey's over yet. You know, I still think I'm trying to get over all those feelings of guilt and those tensions.
Sully, the accusation that a lot of whistleblowers tend to face is that, well, you could only know about this if you are part of it. So talk us through your Damascus moment. Is that a fair accusation?
Well, look, the truth is there are different kinds of whistleblowers. There are people like Bianca who leave as soon as they see that stuff is happening that shouldn't be happening. There are also whistleblowers who do it proactively, after they've left the position. So they look back and say, damn, this is what happened. I signed their paper. Oh, I was in that meeting and I had so-and-so say so. And they go back to say, you know what? I want to tell my part of the story, because I was there when these guys discussed this thing. I was there when this thing was signed. But I think we have to appreciate both the things, and we have to appreciate them, because there are many, many, many others who keep quiet, not because they are bad people. They keep quiet because they are scared of losing their homes, their salaries, their salaries to be able to pay for their kids, the schooling and all. So there are people who will say, you know what, I don't care what I have to lose out of this. I cannot stand this. And there are others who are saying, you know what, I'm a columnist, as you know, that I get a lot of private stuff from people who say, Soli, please, this is what's going on here. And maybe people like Gah, get stuff like that from people who say, please don't mention that, don't say that you got it from me, but I cannot keep quiet. This is what it is. I don't want you to name me because I'm going to lose my job. And if I lose my job, this is what's going to be. These are the repercussions, you know, about the black tax, as it were. I have to pay for my school fees, for my kids, for my sister's kids, for my brother's kids, and for my parents, et cetera, et cetera. So I cannot afford to reveal myself, but I also cannot afford to keep quiet. So we have to appreciate anyone who comes out to say, this is the truth. And the truth is, a lot of the stuff that came out of investigative reporters, a lot of the stuff that we see at the Zondo Commission was initiated by people who said, I can't keep quiet. I cannot looking the other way when this stuff is happening. Even when I'm afraid, I know many people who have come out to say, you know what, I'm scared, but I can't keep quiet. And we know those people, we have to celebrate them.
Solly, I suppose one of the instinctive reactions that most people will have is that as soon as you think something is wrong, as soon as you suspect something is wrong, you report it to your immediate superiors. And in cases where the immediate superiors are the ones that are entangled in it, it becomes a bit tricky. Do you still see a lot of people firstly saying, let me speak internally, let me talk to my boss, let me get an explanation, only for that to eventually end up being used against them?
Well, the thing is that we have to talk about cadre deployment. And why are cadres deployed in state? People are not just deployed in state institutions so that they can get a salary. A lot of times they get in there so that they can make sure that the big tenders go to the right people, to the right entities. All right. Especially that's why the positions of chief procurement officers are important in state institutions. So people get employed in those positions because they have to direct tenders and opportunities to the right people. So we have to take into consideration the fact that when people find themselves in those positions, they have political bosses who say to them, dude, we see there's a tender coming up and this is the amount of the tender and you must make sure that this is where it goes. These are the entities to benefit, for whatever reason. And a lot of those people, many of them are in a position to say, no, I can't do this. Many of them, a few of them are in a position to say, I can't do this. Many of them are saying to themselves, look, if I have to keep my job, this is the price to pay. The price to pay is I must make sure that this tender goes to that guy, irrespective of the conditions.
Yeah, it's scary. Bianca, that spectrum from negligence to criminality, when you first see a transaction and you say, wait, hold on, this doesn't look right, I suspect your instinctive reaction is not that, oh dear God, this must be a crime. You probably think, no, somebody made an error. It's a clerical mistake. It's negligence. Let me get this person to correct it. At what point in time do you then say, actually, this is just not negligence. It's intentional.
You know, and that's the thing. I mean, the amount of times, I mean, I used to come home from work and I used to work at Trillion and I used to have these conversations with my husband like on a daily basis. And he's very reasonable and logical and very ethical man. And, you know, he would say to me, but maybe there's just something you don't understand. What if it's just in your head? You know, so I would start questioning myself, and it is fair to assume that you don't have the whole picture. You know, and I experienced that in the corporates that I've worked with, like Anglo, for example. You know, there were certain things that your bosses or your managers couldn't always tell you. You would only get a half of the story, but you'd still have to act on it, right? But when you're working for an ethical organization, I think generally you don't have to question some of those things because you can trust things like the governance processes. Well, you would hope that you can trust things like that. You know, the naivety on my side working for Trillion was that I assumed, because of the way that I grew up, I assumed that my employer would never deliberately and intentionally put me in a position of risk. You know, that's because that's the corporate culture that I'd come from. But what had happened in the case of Trillion is that there were too many little things that weren't adding up. And I did escalate them. My direct manager in Trillion was Clive Angel, because Eric was still at regiments for the bulk of the time that I was there, right, for January and February. So Eric wasn't my boss. Clive was my boss. And, like, for example, when the Mohammed Bobet story came out in the press in February, you know, the first thing I did the next morning was phone him to say, what is this? Right? He turned around to me and he says, look, you must just understand that there are people that are just going to be really jealous. You know, you do know that we've got a boss who opens the tap.
Yeah.
Now, there was a part of me that also appreciated that, exactly like what Solly was saying, was that you know that there's a relationship or some sort of relation that happens between suppliers and state-owned entities. I'm not saying they're all corrupt, but I'm saying that you just do know that you have to have, call it a connection.
Yeah.
Somebody was not going to let your RFP get lost. Type of thing, you know, and I honestly naively thought that our boss was one of those bosses that just had those connections. I never ever once thought it was a money laundering scheme, you know. So for me, like I said, the straw that broke the camel's back was the Bank of Baroda incident. But in that same week, and I remember it distinctly, it was the 16th of March, it's Masilo Mutepa's birthday. That morning, the CFO of Trillium tells us that they, and points in the direction of Eric's office, wants to replace the finance minister. Now, this was after our economy tanked the previous December.
Yeah,
when we had,
yeah,
you know,
December 2015.
Exactly. So it's like you can't pretend like you don't know what a big thing this cabinet, this midnight cabinet reshuffle have on the economy in the country, right? So there was that happened prior. There were just like these little things like Mohamed Bobet sending me, because now he was in COCTA. He went with Mr. Van Rooyen from the finance department or treasury division to COCTA, sending me these white envelopes, you know, and then emailing me from his Gmail account saying, use this, don't use my work mail. You know, there are these tiny things that some of them are big, like the minister thing is big. But these other things, like just the stupid thing about emails. You know, when I met Irwin Mabalane, who was the head of procurement at Eskom, he says to me, listen, we can't trust our service, so if you want to send me this document, just use my Gmail account. You know, so you don't think it's state capture, or I don't live in a world where everything that doesn't make sense is a conspiracy theory.
Yeah.
And now, after what I've gone through, it's unfortunate that I've become that paranoid now. Mm-hmm. But I never used to be that way. And I hate living like this, because I just think that you should be able to trust society and people reasonably. Not a lot, but reasonably, you know. And this experience for me has taken away that sense of thinking that people can be good. And now I actually work on a basis more that I think everything is bad.
Yeah.
And it's to answer your question directly, it's not just one thing. I think it's a lot of little things. And I think you can't take away from the experience where you do question yourself and you do actually think that you're going mad because you can't quite figure out all these different dots, you know?
And I imagine that's not good for anyone's mental state, and it just creates chaos. We're going to take a short break, and then afterwards we'll engage with some of the tweets from our listeners and also take a couple of calls on 0861-987-000.
Power Perspective with Kaya Setole. Call Kaya on 0861-987-000.
Welcome back to the Monday edition of Power Perspective. We are speaking whistleblowers. I've got two guests with me, Bianca Goodson, the former CEO of Trillium and now a whistleblower, and also Soli Mueng, who's a managing director of Don Valley Reputation Managers. If you'd like to share some of your insights with them, you can call us on 0861-987-000. You can also tweet us at PowerFM987 and also at Karuska Kaya, because I think the insights that they are sharing are very sobering for most of us that are trying to really understand what happens when people become whistleblowers and how we help them as South Africans. Soli, at the point in time where a person then decides to become a whistleblower, and I think in the extreme case like we saw for Bianca, for example, it can't be an easy space. You think there's a fear that if I'm exposing the people and I'm right in saying that this is a criminal enterprise, the first thing criminals tend to do is to eliminate their risks. How do people deal with those tensions?
Yes, say that again.
Yes, sorry. How do people deal with the risk to their lives, for example, when they decide to become whistleblowers? Because if one is correct, if your instincts are correct, and this is indeed a criminal enterprise, the first thing criminals do is they tend to eliminate their risks, don't they?
Yeah. Look, a lot of people do it without thinking very far ahead. I mean, I'm sure that Bianca will correct me on this. People say,
no, that's true.
Yeah, they say this is wrong. I can't be part of it. Full stop. And whatever happens in the future over the bridge, I'll deal with it. And I know, as I said to you, I know people whom I'm trying to get to go to the Zondo Commission who are saying, sorry, I'm scared. I can't go to the Zondo Commission. But you know, even before, at the dawn of our democracy, I've got friends who should have gone to the TLC, okay? Because we have some beautiful stories to tell about what happened. But they say, you know what, sorry, I've dealt with so much pain in my life, I won't go to the TLC. But they have stories that could enrich the history, the records, or our historical records. And you can't force people to go there, but that's why I really always insist that people who stand up and say, you know what, I don't care what happened. It's not like they don't care. It's just that their conscience cannot allow them to go to the next steps of their lives when they know that something is wrong that they could have prevented from happening. So it's not like people think, you know what, where do I go from here? It's like, you know, this is wrong. I can't be part of it. Boom. I'm going to tell the truth. And we have to celebrate those people. We really have to celebrate those. Because a lot of times they jump the river. They say, okay, you know what? I know there are crocodiles in this river. But you know what? I can't stay on this side of the river. I have to go over this river. They cross the river. Some of them get swallowed by, they get taken down for the flow of the river. They get swallowed by crocodiles. Some of them find themselves on the other side. On the other bank, but nobody wants to employ them. They're untouchable. Suddenly, they are being portrayed in the media as the bad people, and we have to talk to Business South Africa, to Corporate South Africa, because Corporate South Africa, in a lot of ways, is complicit. Corporate South Africa was complicit during apartheid. A lot of companies did what the National Party said they must do because they didn't want to lose state tenders and business. But it's happening today. A lot of companies today will stay away from, will not touch you if you tell the truth against the ANC, for instance, because they don't want to lose ANC government control tenders. It's happening today, you know, and this is the pain of it. Corporate South Africa is not innocent. Corporate South Africa needs to stand up and say, this is the South Africa we want to defend, that we want to stand for, and this is what we're going to say to government. This cannot be acceptable. But Corporate South Africa is not always doing that, and Corporate South Africa must be the first one to say, people like Goodson and others, we're going to support. We're going to, if they fail over there, we're going to give them jobs because they stand for the values that we also stand for. But they don't do that.
You know, Solly, when you speak about Corporate South Africa and their fears for ruling political elites, I've got two names for you, Ruel Khoza and Paul Harris. And you know exactly what happened to them when they tried to say something.
There you go. But the other thing is, there's, you know, people forget in South Africa, the fifth, what usually gets referred to as the fifth auditing, biggest auditing firm in South Africa is Sizwe Govoto Ntshaluba. Okay? Those guys, when a very respected national director of public prosecutions, advocate Vusi Pikoli, was suspended by Mbeki, for trying to arrest now the late Jackie Filebe, and then he was fired by Kgalema Motlanthe because he said no. When Kgalema Motlanthe tried to get him to say, okay, I'm happy to reinstate you in your position provided you don't touch Zuma, Vusi Pikoli said, no, I have to act without fear, favor, and prejudice. If this guy has done wrong, I'm going to go after him. Kgalema Motlanthe fired this guy. And then he got a job after he lost his job as National Director of Public Prosecutions. He got a job with this auditing firm.
Yes.
Yeah. And the ANC said to this guy, you can't fire that guy. You can't employ that guy. You can't work. If you work with this guy, you're not getting the next tender. You're going to lose. And these guys will get like 90%, 95% of the business was coming from the government. So the ANC said, you must fire this guy. This is one of the most respected citizens who should celebrate. He was fired. He was fired because the ANC said, you can't work with this guy. This is bullshit. I'm sorry for the language. This is nonsense. It's unacceptable. Okay, but it happens all the time in Corporate South Africa where corporates say to people, we can't employ you because we are afraid of losing our business with government.
Yeah.
It happens all the time. And people, we need to talk about these things. There are many who are afraid, who are hiding, who are not able to come out of their holes because Corporate South Africa can't touch them, because if Corporate South Africa touches them, they're going to lose. Corporate South Africa will lose their business with government.
And I know that episode was well documented in Vusi Pikoli's book, My Second Initiation. So, Power listener, if you'd like to get insight into that story, get a hold of Vusi Pikoli's book. It is probably one of the most glaring examples of how Corporate South Africa didn't live up to the social contract that we all believe that they signed up for. Bianca, you know, when we speak about the risks associated with whistleblowing, somebody may say the risk of losing a job is the worst it could be. But I'm thinking you were in an organization where there are people within the room that could literally say a finance minister is getting replaced, which is already telling you that they've got significant political clout, they've got significant political power. I imagine that the risk to you wasn't just the risk of losing a job. There was a risk of actually something much worse happening to you.
It was, but you know exactly what Solly said earlier. You know, like when you take that jump you know, it's like when you bungee jump, you sort of like, you just have faith that the cord is going to catch you. Right? And my bungee cord, when I decided to leave, was that my competencies and my skills won't change. So I tried to back myself, and Solly's 100% right. I didn't think of the next step. I just saw the next step in that organization as being a continual risk. And the only way that I could mitigate my risk and the only risk that I really, really saw was staying in that organization. So all I needed to do was get out of it. You know, as soon as I resigned, the first thing I did when I got online again was insist that I'm no longer a director of the company. Because I was a director for two of the entities, right? I didn't care about anything. I didn't want to have any conversations with anybody else until they could show me the CIPIC record that I was no longer a director for the organization. So I wasn't thinking ahead, right? My family had no income. We had made a decision that my husband would take a sabbatical at that time. So overnight, we had two unemployed adults in the house with two small children. You know, this wasn't planned. It wasn't intentional. I didn't see part of the risk being that it would put so much trauma on my marriage that I would end up getting divorced, that I would have to end up selling my house, finding a new place, you know, all having custody battles. I didn't see that all kind of decision. And so the risks were absolutely enormous. But when I made the decision, I decided that I was going to back myself. Because again, I think my naivety got the better of me, and I wished that there was decent corporates in South Africa. I always thought to myself, I could go back to the likes of Anglo. Right? I wasn't retrenched. I wasn't fired. I left. You know, when you leave, people are always like remorseful that you're leaving, wishing that you didn't go. I thought I'd have that opportunity to at least go with my tail between my legs to go back to Anglo to say, okay, can I come there? And if it's not Anglo, the mining industry is vast. I figured I'd always be able to pull myself up again. That didn't happen for what Sally just mentioned. You know, so the risks are, I would never, ever, ever encourage my daughter to do what I did. I can say to you now that I may do it again because I'm still on my feet. Right? I haven't completely collapsed and fallen down, although there were moments when I did. But for now, I'm still here and I'm still kicking, you know. But if my daughter one day came to me and said, Mummy, I'm thinking of doing what you did, I would stop her. I would never want her to go through this anguish because the risk was so high and the country failed whistleblowers. The country specifically, and I'm not putting it on so much on corporate South Africa, I'm putting it on the country because I whistleblew against that capture.
Yeah,
I didn't whistleblow against some sort of fraud on a pension fund here or there or something that impacts private sector or whatever. I whistleblew on something that was impacting our country. And our country's failed me. Because there's no consideration for what should be my human rights right now. My dignity, my integrity, all those things have gone completely down the toilet while I'm trying to protect my country. You know, so the disbelief that I sit with and the disappointment that I sit with is very deep.
Sure.
Still don't see the country doing anything to make it better.
Yeah. And right?
You've got these tragic people like me that are trying to advocate, like Ethel, you know, Solly, you know, these individuals that are trying to advocate for change, and maybe sometime the change will take effect, but I'm not that optimistic that it will necessarily be in my lifetime. It may be hopefully for the generations that come after, but that's what I sit with, right?
Yeah. Bianca and Solly, before I move on to the question of what protection mechanisms need to be put in place, Solly, I want to explore this question of how and why whistleblowers become essentially unemployable in South Africa. Why?
Well, the thing is, people feel that all companies have a culture, and some, not all the cultures, if you allow, in different companies are good for place public interest at the heart of it. I think this is the key. I think that what tends to be missing in South Africa is what is good for South Africa. Is is what we're doing good for South Africa or not, or is it good for us? So you could work for a company that says, you know what, we're going to mess people up. We're going to steal money from people. We'll fool people. We're going to create a Ponzi scheme and get rich and get good salaries and good. But we could also work with a company that says, well, we're going to do all of these things, but it's good for public. So every company, I believe that every company in South Africa has to be cognizant of where we come from as a country, from the painful past of colonialism, apartheid, where a large portion of the community, of the society was not taken care of. We need to get, and the pledge that we took, the South Africa that we signed for at the dawn of our democracy was one that would be caring, it's multiracial. We don't have a choice. South Africa will always be multiracial. No matter how many people leave, we'll always be a diverse South Africa. And we must value that as wealth, as an advantage over other people. We must take care of that. So when you have when you work for a company that says, you know, we're going to steal from others, but please keep quiet. Just as long as your bank balance is okay, that's wrong. So it's important that we work all entities. We are part of a bigger South African ecosystem. If one part of the ecosystem doesn't work properly because somebody is messing it, the whole ecosystem gets messed up. So it's important that we have citizens in South Africa who say, I'm happy to get rich here, but I cannot afford to get rich here if it messes up the ecosystem.
Solly, I mean, you also do a lot of work in reputation management. Do you then hear from corporate saying, look, Bianca is a bit of a problem. We don't think she's guilty of anything, but we just would prefer to deal with someone who doesn't have a history of anything relating to whistleblowing? I mean, how do they then justify them saying, actually, the risk is just not the one that we're willing to bear?
Yeah, well, they will not say that. That's a problem. They will not say Bianca is a problem. They would rather not discuss it. But they will, in their actions, you will see they would rather not. The thing is, corporate South Africa, as I say, fails South Africa because it listens more to the politicians who give it tenders and big business for more than they would to what is good for South Africa. So if Solly Mweng, for instance, has spoken out against a company that messed up, that stole money, that directed money to wherever, where it shouldn't go, corporate South Africa would rather listen to government that says, listen, if you point us out over there, you must remember that you're not getting the next tender. And this is precisely what happened. I think the Ntsaluba Kuboto situation with
Sikoli
was the best example of when a big, with the fifth, South Africa's fifth auditing firm was told by ANC that if they employ a particular individual, and this individual didn't commit crime, he didn't do anything wrong against South Africa, he just actually he was protecting the interests of South Africa. But the governing party said to this company, if you employ the dude, you're not going to get more business from government. And that's wrong. This is a problem that we have. And a lot of South African companies would rather look the other way. So they've mastered the art of looking the other way rather than say, but Mr. President or Mr. Ainsley or Mr. Ainsley or Mr. Ainsley, this is wrong. This is not good for the country that we pledged to build for all of us. And that's a problem.
Mm. Bianca, the outlets of whistleblowing is an important one. Everybody will say that by the time you get to the whistleblowing stage, you probably don't have much faith in the internal processes that failed you in cases where they exist, because unfortunately, far too many corporates don't even have those types of systems that enable me to say, hey, actually, I think something's gone wrong here. In the South African context, do we have enough outlets, if you want to call it that, where a person can say, I think something has gone wrong, let me go and sound it out to someone else and hear what their views are?
Absolutely not. In my opinion, we've got nothing. But let me give you an example from my experience. I wanted to make my information public because I copied my computer before I left Trillion, right?
Yeah.
And in 2000 and... I think it was 2016, August 2016, the public...
Bianca, lost it there a bit?
Marinsela.
Yes,
Susie Marinsela had found me. And I had to prepare an affidavit for her. I mean, I went willingly. I was scared. I knew something was wrong straight away when the public protector found you. right? Because it's not the call that every average person gets on like a Wednesday morning.
It's a call no one should get.
100%, right? So the day when I got that call, it's like, then it's like, you really know that the worst thing that happened to me was that my suspicions were confirmed, right? Anyway, so I prepared all this stuff. I had a copy of my computer ready for the public projector. I gave everything, but I did do it on the basis of anonymity because I was scared. And in 2017, I helped Jeff Budlender. Again, I did it on the basis of anonymity. And so you could see these things come out. Like, you could see the state of capture report come out, which was impetus in itself. However, every time I read it, I just thought that if people stood up behind the information, like the way Venky Mentor did it, and our previous finance minister, spoke up and stood by the allegation that they were throwing against the Guptas, for example, I just think that your evidence has so much more impetus.
Yeah.
So I started getting annoyed that I was trying to help the cause, but on an anonymous basis. And at that point in time, I was in connection with a French whistleblowing organization called Pluff, and I had an attorney that was just trying to legally calm me down from not doing something stupid. And I had this interesting conversation with them. And I said, I've already got this affidavit, right? What if I take it and I just go leave it at my nearest police station?
Mm.
Why can't I do that? Technically, according to the Companies Act, that is actually my job.
Yeah,
I should have done that because I was a director for this company. I said, I've got this affidavit. It spells out all the information that I have. Why can't I do that? My attorneys laughed at me.
Mm.
And they said to me, what do you think is going to happen? You know, so yes, there's not enough outlets. You can't even trust the things that legislation tells you to do, right? Mm. I couldn't trust complying with the Companies Act for my safety and for the safety of my family. I couldn't do that, you know? So you got to relook at everything, in my opinion. We need something, legislation, something that even just recognizes whistleblowers. That's the first thing, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
The Precare Act doesn't count. The PDA that we've got doesn't count because that's only in the sense of, like, you know, private, well, not necessarily private sector, but in a corporate. PDA wouldn't help me because I resigned. I didn't want to endure liability, so I left. But all this legislation that we do have would only help me if I stayed in the organization. It wasn't good for me, right? It wasn't good for my family. You know, so we've got this legislation that is intended, but it doesn't protect. So there's no outlet. You can't
and
go.
It left you in limbo. It left you in limbo.
Absolutely. You can't go to, I mean, I remember when I was preparing for the public protector, somebody in my family, I spoke to one of my uncles or something like that. And one of my uncles said, listen, maybe you should consider getting a lawyer.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
So now I'm unemployed. I can't afford lawyer's fees. But I found these people, and I think to myself, hey, if all they're drafting is an affidavit, it can't be that expensive. Nobody, none of the big companies, right, and I don't want to mention them by name, but none of the ones in Stanton, all around Stanton City, could help me because they were conflicted.
Yeah.
You know?
It's a mess.
Because I was speaking out and almost all the SOEs that they all did business with in some way.
Mm.
I had nowhere to go.
Sure.
Yeah. Nowhere to go. I only found solace going to my pastors, and what's the best that they could do? Pray for me. You know, so do we have enough outlets, Kaya? We've got none.
Sure.
That's my view.
Scary. Sully?
Yeah. Can I just one thing? You know, the fact that we have a parliament in South Africa which has people who should be in the courts, in the streets, or in jail, acting, some of whom as chairpersons of parliamentary oversight committees. So basically we have people acting as lawmakers in South Africa, people who should be in jail. What kind of laws do you expect those to? When you have people on the Judiciary Commission that appoints judges who have like shadows hanging over their head, what kind of laws, what kind of judges do you think they will favor to be in there? They're not going to be neutral. This is a problem. So this is the problem that we have in South Africa is systemic. We can't have a system that protects people like Goodson and others, while we have lawmakers and between brackets, lawmakers who have shadows of hanging over their heads, who are constantly looking over their shoulders because they have a lot to run away from. That's the problem. We have to get to a point in South Africa where the minute somebody, we should move away from all. Not found guilty, therefore, as long as you're not found guilty, okay. The minute you get accused of something serious, you need to be taken out of the system. You must go out there and clear your name. When your name is cleared, you can come back. But now we have too many compromised people in the system, and they stay there on the basis of innocent until proven guilty. It's nonsense. It's nonsense because you can't have somebody, people who've really given South Africa over to the Guptas, who are heading parliamentary committees, people who really played, who made state capture possible. We sit in there as lawmakers, and the ANC allows it to happen. All right. So while those people are in there, you can't have a system that says let's protect people like Goodson, because they can't, because those people are speaking out against them. So we have to decide as a country what kind of South Africa do you want to be known for? What do you want to stand for in Africa, in the world? And right now we can't stand on any moral high ground because we've got crooks standing in our national assembly, in parliament, government, as ministers who are some of whom are even out on bail. It's crazy. I mean, like, nowhere in the world do you have people out on bail who are still serving in the national assembly. It's nonsense. It has to stop.
Yeah, and you know, that anxiety that gets created by the fact that you look around, you say, ow, if the people themselves have got entanglements in all these allegations, could they really champion the cause of a whistleblower? And sometimes I struggle to sort of reconcile that with, you know, the fact that they themselves have got enduring issues that you like, actually, you probably should be stepping aside until that cloud is lifted. But Solly, on the other hand, they would argue that the Constitution says everybody has got the right to be presumed innocent. And when you say people must step aside, it may mean that financial losses to them, only for us to discover a year or two later that they were not guilty of anything.
No, let me say this to you. You know what? The fact that something is not illegal doesn't always mean it make it right. So let me give you an example. Let's talk about the parliamentary that booklet that allows ministers to buy themselves executive cars, and I could buy myself. If in a situation where there's so much pain in the country, the fact that the ministerial booklet says I can buy myself a two million rand car. Doesn't mean that I should buy it myself a 2 million rand car. I must look around and say, you know what, there's so much pain in this country. Maybe it's better I can do with a Toyota Corolla or a Toyota something that doesn't cost 2 million rand. So the thing is, we have to get to a point where empathy does matter. Okay, when people are wrong, when something is wrong, it doesn't have to be legally wrong for it to be wrong. There are many things that are wrong that are allowed to pass in South Africa. And people say, you know, because it's not legally wrong, it's okay. And that's a problem that we have in South Africa. When you have, what kind of leadership, what kind of aspiration do you want to create for young people to go to become leaders in the parliament, to lead this country? Okay. When somebody has stolen something, the fact that a judge has not said you're wrong, the fact they have to stand out aside. They have to say, you know what, I've been accused of wrongdoing here. I'm going to stand aside. Okay, to step aside. If I'm proven guilty and the conditions allow me to come back, then I come back. But there are too many people who are compromised. The thing is, if it's an exception, it's one thing. In South Africa, it's not an exception. It's become a norm. It's become the norm. There are too many people in influential positions in South Africa who should not be there. It's become the norm.
And that's it's scary. Sorry, Bianca, I just want to go to Power News now and then come back just after Power News to close off this conversation with questions about what exactly do we do next. It's time for Power News. Welcome back to the Monday evening edition of Power Perspective. My name is Kaya Sithole. We are speaking whistleblowing. We have Bianca Goodson, the former CEO of Trillion, who is now a whistleblower, and also Solly Moeng, the managing director of Donvale Reputation Managers. Bianca, I mean, we've listened to your harrowing story, and of course it is very, very tragic to hear what has happened to you since the time you decided to be a whistleblower. And I suspect that the key thing that we're all trying to get out of here is, what are the lessons for South Africans at large? What is it that you'd like the nation to sort of start doing differently in order to ensure that the next person who decides to raise their arm and say, actually, there's a problem here, doesn't suffer the fate that you've suffered since 2016?
So what I'm doing to try and make a difference, I can only do it one person at a time, and at the moment that person is my young daughter, right? When she was younger, she would come back from school and she would tell me about some sort of transgression that would happen on the playground, and I would say to her, before this stuff happened to me, I would say to her, listen, babe, you know, don't become a tattletale. And she would also then come back sometimes to school and say, but this other person has become a tattletale and so forth. Needless to say, since I've experienced what I've experienced, that word is not used in this house anymore and will never, ever be used again. Right. So my daughter now is encouraged to speak freely without any kind of backlash in any way. I'm trying to encouraging her to encourage others to do the exact same without fear of consequence. And so that's the small change that I'm making in my tiny little bubble in society. I think as far as, you know, I mentioned earlier that I feel that the country failed me. And what I would like to do is go to whatever represents the country, be it the president, be it whoever is supposed to be this person that's supposed to be looking after South Africans generally. I want to take to him the fact that I may lose my house because I can't afford the bond payments anymore, and I want to leave that at his door. I'm not looking for money. I'm looking for security and safety for my daughter and I. I want to take all my bills for therapy and leave it at that person's door. And again, I'm not looking for money. I'm looking to get back to the mental health status that I had before I tried to save my country. I want to take all the trauma and I want to leave it at that person's door. And I want them to do something with it to try and see how can they make this country a better place for people like me to be able to keep doing this. I don't know what the answer is from a greater societal perspective. But I do know that what I can do is at least the people within my sphere of influence, I can at least try and change that culture of what's called tattletaling or in pimpies and stuff. I'm going to do it where I sit. And I think that's all that I can do. I'm trying to get better because I also want to be the example to my kid to say that telling the truth and living by your values doesn't defeat you. So it's important for me to carry on going. But it's not that easy for others. And that's where other people that are responsible for the well-being of the people that are trying to protect the country, they have to step up. We've got things like UIF funds. We've got pay as you earn for when you're unemployed. We've got all these things that are there to take away certain injustices or inconvenient circumstances that people find themselves in. But whistleblowing is not regarded as anything close to that. If in state capture, that's the part where my mind just fails me from a logic perspective. But that's what I do. And I know it's not a crisp, clear answer,
yeah,
but that's the best that I could put forward.
Sure. Thank you very much for that, Bianca. I think, obviously, we're hoping that the authorities are listening and taking some notes. So, the international lessons, what are the things that we could probably say that works there? This is a form of protection for whistleblowers. Let's replicate it.
Well, I think that we have an opportunity in South Africa, having learned from how a lot of the information that that fed into a lot of the investigative reports, journalist reports, or independent media reports, and the Zonal Commission into the public. We have an opportunity in the same way that a lot of countries, like in Northern Ireland, about the conflict in Northern Ireland, they came to South Africa and said, help us. How do you deal with such a thing? And some people, actually, Cyril Ramaphosa and Rolf Meyer were invited to Northern Ireland to come and help them, guide them through that protracted conflict that pitted Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland and the UK. We need to create an opportunity for ourselves to say, this is how we deal with these things. But the thing is, these things don't happen without leadership. We need the kind of leadership in South Africa that puts the country ahead of any political party, whether it's DA, ANC, EFF. And we're not there yet. It's a pity that Ramaphosa had such an opportunity to say, you know what, I don't care what the ANC wants. Of course I care, but I care more about South Africa. But he's not there. He's not that kind of president. We need to South Africa has an opportunity for the world, for Africa, to say, this is what they did. It wasn't easy. Let's learn from them. And I think that there's an opportunity to say, how do we protect whistleblowers. How do we create in South Africa a platform and a policy, I don't know, some kind of arrangement that protects whistleblowers that other people from the rest of Africa, from the rest of the world will learn from? Because the fact of the matter is, when you don't have people in power who put the interests of country ahead of party, you end up with where we are with South Africa. We need the kind of leadership that says South Africa comes first no matter what. Mm. Okay? And then whoever betrays the spirit, the vision of what we want to be as a country must be pushed aside, irrespective of whether they are my friend or their brother, my sister. South Africa is here to stay. All political parties are not here to stay, but we're not there yet.
Yeah. And you know, just the journey of us getting there is probably something that requires the type of decisive leadership that a lot of people say that we're not exhibiting in the country in many instances. Bianca, one point that has been raised by one of our listeners is that perhaps the closest we get to any form of protection for people that say something has gone wrong is through formal witness protection programs. But that doesn't come without its consequences. You probably have to get a new identity, move to a different country. It's not easy either way. Bianca?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now.
Yeah, you know, the thing is, I mean, I chose to whistleblow for myself, and I was prepared to take on the consequences as they would be imposed on me. But the consequences that I live through impact all the people that I love. You know, this whistle protection thing could be, I think it's fair if you find yourself in danger, if you find yourself, you know, there are times that I wish I could actually do that now. I wish I could just pack up and go somewhere and start again. But I can't uproot my daughter. I can't just leave my parents. You know, and I did what I did because I love this country. I don't want to leave it. I still want to try and see what I can do to make it better. You know, so it may be an option. And I think it definitely is an option for those people that are, you know, physically threatened for themselves and their families. And that would still be something in the absence of nothing. So I agree with you, listener. But it's not the silver bullet, yeah. I don't think.
Solly, I mean, the fact that such a system exists of, you know, witness protection means that the state does understand the need to allocate resources to protect individuals who have gone all out to protect the bigger public interest. Isn't there a way of then trying to replicate some aspects of that to say, well, even if people are not uprooted, even if they don't have to get new identities, we understand that there is a resource constraint that comes with people having said no more?
Well, there's a difference between the state understanding the need to protect the whistleblowers and the state actually doing so. But the thing is, when you have the state being run by people who are afraid, who have a lot of fear from whistleblowers, then we can't get there. That's a problem. My heart bleeds when Amanda says, I don't want my daughter to go to do the same thing I did, because I want us to create a South Africa where her daughter is able to say, during my mom's time, it was not possible. During my time, it's possible. I can
agreed.
Do this for South Africa and get away. I don't want her to say, I don't want my daughter to whistleblow in the future. We need to create a situation where her daughter doesn't have to go through the same thing. But we can't create a South Africa when South Africa is run by criminals or suspected criminals in parliament. I mean, I'm sorry, that's the truth. There are people who are heading the important oversight committees of parliament who are deputy ministers who don't care about South Africa, who think that the ANC is more important than South Africa, who are themselves implicated in wrongdoing. The ANC should say, you know what, this is not the South Africa that we stood in the trenches for. This is not the South Africa that we fought for, that so many of our comrades died for. You can't stand for the South Africa, but that's not what they're doing. They're saying you are part of the ANC, we'll defend you no matter what, and that's wrong. So therefore, the ANC, what is good for the ANC is no longer good for the South Africa. What's good for the South Africa? That's where we are at today.
I think that's the great tragedy of the state that we're in right now, where unfortunately party and political interest trumps the greater good. And I think it's just a great tragedy. Bianca, there is one message that I'd like to read out for you. It says here, people are evil to an extent that they can sacrifice the life of an innocent person just to cover up their dirty deeds. I hope her life is not threatened. That is a reference to you, Bianca. Any parting words?
No, I just, you know, as much as I'm aware that my story is not a great one, I agree with Solly completely. I think that my journey would be completely worth it if a generation later things do change. So I hope that even although I do share my story with your listeners, I hope that they don't get despondent from doing the right thing. I still feel proud of myself. I still feel that I can sleep better at night. I'm proud of the fact that my daughter can see some value and significance in her mom. I'm proud that I could represent the values that my parents, you know, brought me up with. And then I really do believe that I still represent, and I do firmly represent, the society that Solly talks about that we need in our country. You know, and for those reasons, I feel very proud of myself. So there is hope and there is good things. It's just I think the journey to traverse that, to get to the other side, is going to be a bit long. And I think it's going to be maybe a bit difficult.
Yeah. Thabo from Mamelodi would like to say something. Good evening, Thabo.
Hey.
Yes, Thabo?
I'm good. Kaya, you know, if we were to be realistic about the issue, corruption in this country, it dominates. The people who are straight, they're out there in the cold. Others have been fired. You know, that is why there will never, ever be any protection for them. Because of the very same people that are supposed to organize protection for those whistleblowers are the ones that are corrupt. So these people, you know, they are being, you know, messy because they have to protect their corruption, but the whistleblowers are clearly disturbing them. So that is why we have so many political killings in KZN where people have been killed, but there was no protection at all. So we must know that corruption in this country, it dominates those that are straight.
Thank you very much, Thabo from Mamelodi. And I think obviously the story of the whistleblower in the Sindiso Magatla case in particular is the one that is referring to. Solly, one final word from you, sir.
I really, you said it earlier, I hope that those who lord it over our affairs are listening, and that I hope that they remember where we come from as a country. There's a lot of hope in Africa of South Africa leading, of South Africa being that country that make people proud of having black people running a modern democracy. But we can't run this modern democracy when we allow people who shouldn't be in the system to remain in the system and determine how the system is going to run. We can do better than this. I really believe that South Africa can do better than this, and we can't do it without some sacrifices.
All right. Thank you very much to my two guests, Solly Mueng, the Managing Director of Don Value Reputation Managers, and also Bianca Goodson, the former CEO of Trillion and a whistleblower.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.